Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we speak to an Israeli priest who shares insight into finding a common language in the dialogue for peace in the Middle East. And it was one of Christ's apostles who brought Christianity to the shores of India some 2,000 years ago. We'll find out who it was. This past January, I accompanied a group of European and American bishops to the Holy Land on their annual pilgrimage to express their support for local Christians, a population which has dwindled to less than 2% due to the economic difficulties and ongoing conflict. Well, besides visiting local Christian parishes in the West Bank and Israel and meeting with the faithful, the bishops also heard experts on a wide range of issues that concern the future of the Holy Land's small Christian community and the future of peace in the whole region. I was particularly struck by one of these seminars where Arab Christians living in Israel faced off with Arab Christians from the West Bank on the language of hatred, mistrust, and fear that permeates the political and social dialogue in the Holy Land. Both sides disagreed over whether Christianity's language of love could hold the answer to peace. Well, I wanted to hear from someone who would know the answers from more than just one side. So I asked Latin Patriarchal Vicar Father David Neuhaus to help me understand the subtleties of tensions between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. A former Israeli Jew, today he works with the Hebrew and Russian-speaking Catholics in Israel.
Our diocese is a little divided on the question of how to engage with Israelis and whether to engage with Israelis. Because if we lay it out in a very, very kind of flat way, we have Jordanians for whom Israelis are on the other side of an international border. Most Jordanians never meet Israelis and probably retain a kind of stereotype that Israel is the enemy against which we have been fighting for generations. Then we have Palestinians who live in the territories that came under Israeli occupation in 1967, and for them the Israelis are real but completely confined in settlers, soldiers, and policemen. For them, that's Israel. And then we have the Palestinian Arabs who came under Israeli rule in 1948 are Israeli citizens themselves, are part and parcel of Israeli society, although their struggle is from a place of marginalization. Their real struggle is for equal rights, for their own dignity as Israeli citizens. And they engage with Israeli Jews wherever they meet Israeli Jews. That means in day-to-day life, in the workplace, in hospitals. They live as a part of Israeli society. Their struggle, as I say, is for integration and equal rights. But they see a wide array of what Israeli society is. They speak the language of Israel. The Palestinian Arabs who are Israeli citizens are all, or almost all of them, fluent in the Hebrew language. They can open the newspapers, read, see the movies. They are part of the culture. And so it's no surprise then that we have very different perspectives on how to or whether to engage with the Israeli Jewish reality.
It wasn't that long ago that it was before the wall, obviously, that you would see sometimes Jewish people in an Arab village doing their shopping and so on. You don't see that anymore. And what does that mean for the reality on the ground, for knowing the other?
Well, I think that the wall has had a very dramatic effect on effacing the Palestinian presence. Israelis, particularly those who don't live anywhere near Jerusalem or near the 1949 border, Israelis who are not settlers, they hardly ever see Palestinians. Palestinians have become something of a news item. You hear about them on the news. And here we, of course, are talking about the Palestinians who came under Israeli rule as a result of the 1967 war. Even though that you are right in saying that Israelis did frequent places like the Bethlehem Market, the Beit Jala furniture stores, Ramallah restaurants before the erection of the wall, there still was never really an engagement with Palestinian reality. I think it's very unfortunate, and I say this as an Israeli Jew, that the teaching of the Arabic language was never taken seriously within the Israeli school system, so that Israelis were meeting Palestinians, but it was inevitably a very superficial meeting. The entire Arab world slowly became more and more absent, not only because of the physical wall that was constructed, but because the new generations of Israelis, a very big percentage of whom have their grandparents coming out of the Arab world, can no longer engage with the Arab world. The Arab world has become a complete enigma to them. And I think it's very important here to recall that a big percentage of the Israeli population are the descendants of Jews who were Arab Jews. Here we are speaking about Arab Christians. But there was a time when there were Arab Jews, Iraqis, Egyptians, Yemenites, Syrians, Lebanese, Egyptians, a whole Jewish Arab civilization that has been wiped out. Wiped out, of course, it's a kind of cultural disparition, a disappearance. And I think that this is very sad because it makes the wall even more of a reality. The wall is not only that concrete and barbed wire that cuts across the face of this land, but a kind of curtain has come down between Israeli Jews and the Arab world, which makes dialogue very, very much more difficult.
Is there a need then to find some sort of common language? I mean, it was brought up here that maybe the Christian language of love, hope, and so on may not be the right language to use at this moment. So how do you find the right language that goes for, you know, that you can deal with in for three different, very different communities?
Okay, here I think that love language is the right language for, because we are Christians and that is the language we speak. That is the language we must speak, even with the enormous challenges of a conflict that is ongoing and all the pain and suffering of the people who are living within the conflict. We must speak the language of love. When we speak about a common language within the political process, I think that that language for too long has been very superficial. First of all, it's been a language that has been imposed from the outside. All that language of peace process and dialogue that was brought with very good intentions by the different American administrations has difficulty sinking down when there is such incredible mistrust between the two sides, two sides that each one feels victim and hurt. So that when we say a common language, yeah, we can hope that a common language will be born, but it's difficult to imagine when there is no real meeting going on. So that I don't really see how we can do anything else than what we are called to as Christians, a tiny, tiny minority, less than 2% in either of the two societies we're talking about, whether it's Israel or Palestine. We need to continue living what we are called to live, which is the language of love. I think that we need to continue crossing the borders. We need to inculcate, at least in our own children, the respect of the other, and more than the respect of the other, getting to know the other, in the hope that this might be a light that is needed. We're called to be the salt of the earth, the yeast and the dough, that this will be taken up and turned into a way in which, way beyond the Christian community, people will see that this has value. I want to go back again to the question of language. I think it's very important. As you saw, a confrontation between two Palestinian Christians, both of them absolutely committed to their Christianity, to their Palestinian identity, one coming out of the West Bank, with only the experience of an Israeli occupation, the other coming out of a real Israeli Jewish Hebrew-speaking experience. We studied together in the university. He's an integral part of Israeli society. Here, I think it's very important that we speak to each other so that we can further develop this Christian language, which might be able to become some kind of paradigmatic experience for our country. We can dream of that. We can hope that that would eventually become the case. What we need to do is continue working on the language of love within a situation which is so loveless. Around us, we're surrounded by the very loud discourses of hate. What I think is very important is that we reach out beyond the community and identify those in the Muslim community, those in the Jewish community, who also are struggling to formulate a language that would be very close to ours. We are not completely alone, neither in Muslim society, Palestinian civil society, nor in Israeli Jewish society. There are people out there who are looking for collaborators with their efforts to engage in this culture of peace, respect, justice, dignity. And I think that we need to really look around us and build these fronts that hopefully will grow.
We've been speaking here mostly about what we can do. What you, as an Israeli of Jewish heritage, what would you suggest to the Jews, to the politicians on the other side, that they can do to move this process along?
I think that here we have to come to terms with the fact that we must pay the price of peace. I'm very fortunate in that within Israeli society I've always found fellow travelers, people who are concerned with these issues of justice and peace, human rights and dignity. And that's why I say with such emphasis that they're out there, the people are out there. To my political leaders, I would say that the word resistance from within Israeli society is what I say to political leaders with whom I don't identify. Okay, I feel very alienated from the present political leadership of the State of Israel. I feel, and here speaking more a Jewish language than a Christian language, they are betraying something fundamental in our history as Jews. And that is, for hundreds and hundreds of years, we had an experience of powerlessness. Have we lost any sense of compassion for what that means? And I know this from many Jews who might not be able to formulate brilliant political analyses of the situation, but who are broken, because they see that we have become a powerful people like any other powerful people, completely without compassion. And this is, I think, the terrible reality of what happened during the last Gaza campaign. The lack of compassion was something that struck me very, very strongly from many, many of my Jewish Israeli brothers and sisters. And seeking out those Jewish Israelis who did feel like this was something that should not be happening, this is something we should not be doing, we should not be bombing concentrations of civilians. Here we huddled together, trying to console one another. And here I think again the question of hope becomes central. The Christian message of hope that God is faithful, God is just, God is loving, and therefore we must never lose faith that even in the darkest moments the light will come. By the way, this also connects to my South African experience, where I was called many times to remind my Israeli brothers and sisters that in the mid-80s, when South Africa was really at some of its darkest moments, most people could not imagine that within 10 years there would be a political solution to the problems of South Africa. God works in surprising ways. I think that that's what gives us the strength and courage to continue. The fidelity and the constant surprises that God prepares for us.
And a very warm thanks there to Father David Neuhaus, Latin Patriarchal Vicar in Jerusalem. Account for just 3% of India's 1.1 billion strong population, and about 2% of them are Catholic. Christians have been practicing their faith in the mostly Hindu nation for almost 2,000 years. But how did they first get there? It was St. Thomas of Doubting Thomas fame who first brought the good news to the huge East Asian nation. Centuries of oral traditions say Christ's apostle traveled there about the year 52 AD, when it's said he landed on India's southwestern shore of Malabar. Well, Father Bernie O'Connor of the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches told me more about St. Thomas's Christian legacy in India, and especially about how Christianity evolved there.
Here we are, we're going back to the first century A.D. Thomas, Paul, Peter, all the apostles are traveling around. Thomas finds himself in India. There is a small Jewish community there, but there must be a lot of other cults, including Hinduism, which are being practiced at the time.
Most certainly. I think that that's certainly correct. When Thomas arrived in India, he certainly would have found the Jewish presence conspicuous, but it's not certain he was entirely welcomed. It probably became a sort of port of call, make the acquaintance and then feel a little bit uncomfortable and moving off in another direction. Hinduism would have been the dominant religion, no question about it. The time that St. Thomas settled into his ministry, you would have had Hinduism as the majority. You would have had little movements within Hinduism, such as Jainism. And then you would have had a presence of Buddhism. So these three were actively associated with the areas in which he worked and ministered. Hinduism was well established in India, certainly by the time Thomas arrived. It's a 3,000-year-old religion before he ever stepped his toes on the Malabar coast. Among the views which it held, and this is significant, is what we know as the caste system, where people were defined according to their work. You had the very top-level class, known as the Brahmins, who we would associate with the intellectual elite. And it was to these that Thomas appears to have first addressed his message. And the result of that is that seven Christian communities arose from within the Brahmin caste, the highest level of caste. And the continuity of those, even today, we can find evidence of their having existed. But it's fascinating that he concentrated within that element. And the question arises, why? Well, perhaps it was because being intellectual, they were curious about matters of belief and understanding of the nature of philosophical questions and religious questions. They were open to listen, and they did listen, and they did respond. So Thomas focused his energy within those communities, and the results, of course, became known to us today, particularly in Kerala.
Well, of course, they would have also been able to read and write at that time.
Yes, but again, we're working with a predominantly oral tradition, mm-hmm. both within the culture and surrounding the culture. So Thomas preached. He addressed his message orally, as would have been the case within his homeland. It would have been the same. Definitely, Thomas certainly would have been able to read and write. He would have understood various languages.
Because the apostles were given the gift of tongues.
They were given the gift of tongues, but I wouldn't want that to be taken too literally. Because the miracle at Pentecost wasn't so much a miracle of speaking, it was a miracle of understanding. People understood them in their own languages. It's not that the apostles necessarily spoke those other languages.
We touched on it just briefly about how Christianity evolved in India, but give me a little bit more information about that. Over the centuries, how did Christianity and even the Catholic Church evolve?
Well, evolve is the word I think you very wisely chosen. Okay, let's starting with St. Thomas's ministry. He's dying probably in Mylapore about the year 72. From the 4th century on, you find a change. The local communities, which have maintained Thomas's legacy, maintained the basic understanding of doctrine we even have today, there becomes an influence of what is called East Syrian tradition. Bear in mind, the life in the Western part of the world, including Rome, was in chaos. It was disintegrating. Communications became very, very poor. Contact, association became difficult to maintain. So from roughly the 4th until the 11th centuries, what happens is that those who became known as the St. Thomas Christians relied upon the influence of East Syria. Today it's present-day Iraq and Iran. And the Catholicos of an area known as Seleucia Ctesiphon, the head of the Iraq area, as we know it for the church, actually was requested to appoint bishops. There was a problem. If we can't get bishops through the intervention of Rome or through where else, where are we going to get them? So they turned to East Syria. the presence of East Syria in India was well known at that point. And for all those centuries, the East Syrians appointed bishops for India. Now, the interesting thing is that they tended to appoint not Indians, but their own Persians who went to India as Bishop of the St. Thomas Christians. And it wasn't until 1597, in fact, that we have the last East Syrian appointed bishop who dies at what is known as Angamali, a major Christian site, Mar Abraham. And then we have a drastic change. Going back just a little earlier, 100 years, 1498, you have the arrival of Portuguese explorers and adventurers. Vasco da Gama comes to mind. And he arrives at Kochi, and he goes to Costa Code and various places. And what he does is began to examine with the missionaries who were with him the state of Christianity as they understood it among the Indian people. They were surprised to find a Christian presence. But what they thought is that it was a heretical Christian presence. Mm. Now, typical of a Western outlook, they don't have the same vestments. They don't have the same liturgical books. They don't have the same emphasis in their liturgy. They must be heretical. And they found occasional references to an individual known as Nestorius, what they thought were references to this well-known heretical teacher. And they concluded, therefore, that Thomas Christians were heretical, and that the best thing could be done was obliterate their tradition and history, annihilate it, and Latinize the whole batch, so we'll all look and act alike. Very Western in outlook. Now, the tragedy of that is that the Portuguese influence then took over, becomes known as Padroado, and the Portuguese acquired and maintained the right to appoint bishops. So the East Syrians disappear from the picture, the Portuguese enter the picture, and the Portuguese want total Latin church. Now, the result of this, there was a famous synod in 1599, known as D'Emper, in which there were concrete efforts made to Latinize the Thomas Christians. Over the years, there was a great resentment, and appropriately so, to this Latinization process. And with the result, in 1653, there was an oath called the Kunin Cross Oath, whereby the Thomas Christians said, basically, we've had quite enough of this. So there was a period of separation. Others lived quietly under Latin domination. And it caused a great deal of division, of discord, of strife. And a number of the St. Thomas Christians to this day have not returned to communion with Rome as a result of the Latinization policies of of that era. Interestingly enough, one of the groups with whom I work, known as the Siramalankara Church, re-entered communion with the Holy See only in 1930. And today number about 500,000, absolutely remarkable and exemplary church. So fundamentally, you can see the movement. St. Thomas, then East Syrian influence, then Padroado Latinization influence. You see, as early as 1700, attempts by the Holy See to try to enter into the picture in some way to bring a little more accord. Propaganda, evangelization of peoples, we call it, begins to seek to have representation and to have a voice. Delegations are sent to Rome as early as 1778 to try to work out some kind of method in which this kind of division can cease. What eventually happens, 1887, Pope Leo XIII decides on the separation of Latin Catholics in India and Malabar or Thomas Christians. So now we're going to see two different aspects of the church active within the Indian situation. And by 1896, we're seeing dioceses called vicariates set up in Trishur, Ernakulam, Chenganeshery. And this continues on to the point that in 1992, eventually, you have the Syro-Malabar Christians being designated as a sui juris, or autonomous church communion within the Catholic family. And that basically is the situation we have today. In India, we have the Latin Christians. Think back to Vasco da Gama and the missionaries and adventurers. We have the Malabar Christians. Think back to St. Thomas himself. You have the Malankara Church. Again, think in terms of the division that unfortunately came about in the 17th century and its eventual restoration in 1930. So there we are today.
Now, what about the dialogue between these different communities?
There are segments of the St. Thomas Christian, for example, Jacobites, which are not in communion with the Holy See. But the Malabar have never broken association with the Holy See or fidelity. In fact, this becomes a point of remarkable pride, and the Malabar tradition absolutely rejoices in the fact that their communion has been an unbroken one from St. Thomas himself.
So it's
a
same,
wonderful, absolutely.
But it's the St. Thomas Church, then, that is not in full communion with...
Well, the St. Thomas Christians are not monolithic. You have the Malankara are a part of the St. Thomas Christians. Mm-hmm. You have the Syro-Malabar are St. Thomas Christians. And you also have various Orthodox churches in India that are recognized as having had descendancy lineage, if you will, from St. Thomas. And some of those are not part of the Catholic communion. Some are, some aren't, within the whole St. Thomas family. So the term St. Thomas Christians is an umbrella one, and it covers this, the whole scope of those both in communion and not.
Okay. Now, how is the dialogue going between those who are in communion and those who are not?
I think this is a very important question. But let's take it back a little further. What about dialogue among those in communion? In the Catholic Bishops' Conference of India, the current president and the current vice president are Eastern Christians. They're St. Thomas Christians. The majority of the members of the conference are, however, Latin. So we already have a wonderful symbol of the fact that the three rites not only coexist, the three rites cooperate, and they seek ways to develop mutual understanding and exchange and reciprocity. I would like to see that furthered still, but I'm very encouraged by the many signs of hope for an exemplary expression of dialogue within the three churches in communion in India. Now, for those outside communion, I notice at the house where I live, the Domus Romana here in Rome, that periodically there will be delegates from various Orthodox churches who will come to Rome for consultations with the Council of Christian Unity. And among them are various Orthodox traditions of India who are not in communion. Jacobite is one I've mentioned. And they will tell me increasingly of the respect that they have for one another, of using research resources together, of sometimes setting up social services and charitable institutions and assisting each other in that process. They'll talk about their love and commitment to the example given by the major archbishops, Fathia Thill and Mark Clemens. And it's a wonderful, wholesome spirit that they tell me has not been consistent in modern history, but certainly is evident today. So dialogue continues, and I'm very optimistic, and I've heard from some bishops the expectation it may result in full communion within our lifetime.
Oh, wouldn't that be
wonderful?
For
many, many of these Eastern non-communion churches.
Father Bernard O'Connor there from the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches. A very warm thanks to him. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.